I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, the push for democratic reforms in Bahrain. Syrian children struggling for education. Libya trying to contain a crime wave. And a new report on a water drain in the Middle East.
I'm quite concerned about it on a personal level, and I hope that the rest of the world is too.
It's all ahead. Unrest continues in Bahrain, where demonstrators are marking the second anniversary of the start of an Arab Spring in that nation. Carla Babb has this look at the conflict.
The uprising in the Kingdom of Bahrain has swelled and ebbed over the last 2 years, but the push for democratic reforms and civil rights is still strong. The country's Shia majority says it is being crushed by the Sunni-controlled government. Bahrain rights activist Mariam Al-Khawaja says the government is punishing its people.
We're still seeing cases of extrajudicial killings, excessive use of force, kidnappings, torture, all kinds of torture, physical, psychological, and sexual.
The near-daily protests in the small Gulf state often end in violent confrontations between protesters and police. Mohamed El-Maskati was detained without charge and fined for running a human rights organization without a government license.
I get death threats from unannounced people. I don't know who is this. I get calls from unannounced people saying, if you are continuing your work, we will be in danger.
In a major escalation of the conflict, troops from neighboring Sunni-run Gulf states rolled into Bahrain in March 2011 to crush the protests. This week, Bahrain's government and the opposition held reconciliation talks for the first time in 18 months. Salman Al-Jalahma, the media attaché at Bahrain's embassy in Washington, says the monarchy is committed to reform.
The mistakes are no secret. They happened, they were admitted, they were reported, and they're being addressed.
The government says dialogue, without preconditions, can end the deadlock.
We definitely want to get everyone on the table, and we encourage citizens to actually assist Bahrain and the government to providing a stable platform for these discussions to go on, instead of provoking and aggravating an already very volatile environment.
But protesters say they need accountability first.
The government, with everything that they're doing on the ground, it's as if they're setting up the dialogue for failure. You cannot keep shooting people on the streets and say, come sit at the dialogue table.
The opposition plans more demonstrations to continue its call for change. Carla Babb, VOA News, Washington.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon Thursday, ahead of his first official meeting with the new U.S. Secretary of State, spoke of the urgency of ending the nearly two-year-old conflict in Syria.
The tragedy continues to deepen without any prospect of political resolution. Nearly 70,000 people have already been killed. UN agencies are mobilizing humanitarian assistance for growing numbers of refugees and displaced people, both inside and outside of Syria. And also both government-controlled areas and also opposition forces-controlled areas. Joint Special Representative Lakhdar Brahimi and I are calling Security Council to be united and speak and act in one voice. And we support the initiative by Muaz Al-Khatib, head of Syrian National Coalition for Dialogue with Syrian Authorities. This is an opportunity we should not miss.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. U.S. State Department spokesperson Victoria Nuland told reporters Thursday the United States is focused on helping the Syrian opposition to begin a political transition, including talks with embattled President Bashar al-Assad.
We're not satisfied with the current state of affairs. We've got to continually work together to increase the pressure on Assad, to support the opposition, to try to move this from the battlefield to a political transition process, working together. If Assad will not cooperate in that, we're going to have to increase the pressure in all of the ways that we can, and we're continuing to look at how we can do that.
Secretary Kerry said yesterday he was looking for common grounds with the Russians. Any ideas how it could be found?
Well, again, you know that we've been looking for common ground with Moscow on Syria for more than a year. I think he is obviously interested in continuing to talk about the Syrian opposition coalition's proposal that they would be willing to talk to individual members of the regime and to encourage Russia to support the SOC in that. You will see that Moscow's announced that Mr. Al-Khatib will go to Moscow, so he'll presumably be following this up. I would also note that the Syrian Opposition Coalition itself is meeting in Cairo. I think they started today and they'll go for the next couple of days. And our understanding is that their goal there is to take this initial proposal for talks that that Mr. Khatib's put on the table and put some more flesh on it, come to some more consensus about how they would take it forward if the offer were to be taken up.
U.S. spokesperson Victoria Nuland. Syria's two-year-old civil war has displaced an estimated 2 million people. More than one half of them are schoolchildren. Some of the camps for the displaced are opening schools. VOA's Scott Bob reports from the Bab al-Salama camp in northern Syria.
School day at the Bab al-Salama school in northern Syria. Several classes study under this tent, one of four pitched on the edge of camp not far from the border with Turkey. About 1,000 children attend classes for 3 hours each day. Because of a lack of space, there are two shifts, one in the morning, another in the afternoon. 20-year-old Hassan fled from Aleppo 6 weeks ago. A teacher of Arabic by training, he teaches several different classes, including these fourth graders. Hassan says attendance is not mandatory. Some children help their parents by working in the camp, but most of them want to go to school. Hassan says school provides some structure to the children's lives and it exercises their minds, which is important. But it also helps them fight boredom and forget the trauma of war. Scott Bob, VOA News, Bab al-Salama camp, northern Syria.
Major cities in Libya are struggling to contain a crime wave that is affecting everyday life. The country has seen a rash of assassinations and kidnappings. The government is relying on revolutionary militias it has pledged to disband to aid in a crackdown. But Jamie Detmer reports from Tripoli, even that isn't helping.
Assailants invaded Ashraf Abdul Wahab's house while he was away recently and at gunpoint evicted his wife, two young sons, and his 70-year-old mother. His house is the seventh in his Tripoli district to have been taken over by petty criminals and drug dealers. There are more than 100 cases in Tripoli of similar house invasions, prosecutors say, and Wahab doesn't know where to turn.
I'm feeling that Libya gets crushed in a wall or something like that because there were no security at the moment.
The 47-year-old local journalist has been seeking help from the police. He's even appealed to Prime Minister Ali Zidane, who this week himself asked Western and Arab allies at a conference in Paris for assistance with deteriorating security in Libya. Mr. Zidane ordered a roundup of the criminals who invaded Ashraf's house, but his family has not returned home as no arrests have been made.
I spoke to Dr. Zidane himself, face to face, alone, in his office. And I told him my problem, and he responded, as I told you. But he responded just for one day, and maybe not just one day, it's a few minutes. And after that, everything is as it is.
Insecurity is part of everyday life in Tripoli. The capital has seen a series of kidnappings, from the deputy head of the National Fire Service to the chairman of a major manufacturing company. Most of the kidnappings have been for money and are not politically motivated. Carjacking is rife. At a loss, the government has given the green light to revolutionary militias in the capital to confront criminals. But this has placed the government in a dilemma. It is pledged to disband the militias, but now is using them as crime fighters. And some argue that the militias themselves are also contributing to insecurity. The Nawezi militia, a hardcore Islamist brigade, has been battling drug dealers, and their nightly firefights have been echoing around the Belishore district of the capital. But the Nawezi brigade has also been accused of rounding up gays, and last year its members were involved in the illegal destruction of an historic Sufi mosque. Abdul al-Wahhab Mohammed Kayid, chairman of the Parliament's National Security Committee, says things will be better when the militias are integrated into the armed forces.
The plan of the Minister of Interior is a very ambitious plan, and they plan to absorb all and adopt all these people you mentioned.
He urges patience. Establishing law and order will take time. This isn't music to Ashraf's ears. He says he would return home, but worries about his family.
I'm not afraid to get back, but I'm afraid of my family, because maybe with the mass of the weapons around the country, somebody to shoot one of my kids or my wife or my mother, this is my problem now.
It is also Libya's problem. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Tripoli.
Egypt's economy continues its downward spiral, with political divisions and sporadic unrest hampering a change for the better. The government has come up with a package of reforms to help secure a much-needed loan from the International Monetary Fund. VOA's Elizabeth Arad has details from Cairo.
Long lines of cars outside gas stations in Cairo signal the latest shortage to hit post-revolution Egypt, diesel fuel. This driver says he has spent the past 2 days looking to fill up his car. Whether it's a lack of basic commodities or the inflated prices of those available, the daily challenges facing Egyptians have grown increasingly dire. The larger picture is also bleak. Foreign reserves are dwindling, with some raising the specter of bankruptcy. Economist Magdi Sobhi Youssef of the Al Ahram Center in Cairo. He says if things carry on as they are now, they'll likely get worse in the coming months, and Egypt might have to rely solely on foreign aid. Since the old government was ousted in 2011, Egypt has been locked in a circle of a bad economy adding to political unrest, and political unrest adding to the bad economy. Instability has kept foreign investors away, as well as tourists, a major revenue source. A travel agent near Tahrir Square is nervous about what comes next.
We don't know how things are going to happen or what is going to be the future of everyone. For me, as I'm working in the tourism domain, this is really a big problem. I'm suffering.
His plight is echoed by many across the country who see economic hardships mounting. Political activist and influential blogger Wael Khalil says the government must move quickly.
An important element of the discontent is many people are not finding jobs, or things are not improving for them, or not having a stable or secure job.
So far, the government has been unable to provide a quick fix on the street level. But this week, officials said they had come up with a consensus plan to secure a key loan from the International Monetary Fund. Details, though, were slim, and there was no firm date set for further talks. The IMF loan is seen as an important form of validation for Egypt, opening the way for other foreign loans and investments. But there's a catch. Meeting the terms of the loan will likely mean austerity measures, and that, based on past history, will likely lead to further street protests. Economist Youssef worries the mainly Islamist government lacks any concrete plan. He says they're dealing with the idea that God's satisfaction will be enough to handle all problems. He adds that imagining a miracle will occur is not good politics. And with Egypt edging toward the brink, analysts say it makes for bad economic policy as well. Elizabeth Arad, VOA News, Cairo.
VOA invites you to share a glimpse of your life through photography and become eligible to win a new iPad. VOA helps give you insights into the world. Now we want you to share your world with us. Send us your best photos, ones that capture the spirit or the essence of the people and places in your life. VOA judges will choose a winner. For a complete list of contest rules, go to voanews.com/iPad. Thousands of Sunnis rallying in cities throughout Iraq are calling for Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki to step down amid accusations of unfair treatment by the country's Shiite-led government. The latest round of protests began today after weekly Muslim prayers in several predominantly Sunni cities, including Fallujah, Ramadi, Samarra, Mosul, and Kirkuk. Demonstrators also gathered in Baghdad under heavy security. The rally is part of weekly Friday demonstrations that erupted in December in western Anbar province in protest of Mr. Maliki and his government's majority Shiite rule, which Sunni protesters say marginalizes their sect. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says if Iran's nuclear program is peaceful, it should have no trouble proving it. Mr. Kerry told reporters Thursday that nuclear talks with Iran later this month can make progress only if Iran is determined to make real offers and engage in a real dialogue. He said it is incumbent on Iran to prove it is open to a diplomatic resolution.
I want to reiterate that these talks can only make progress if the Iranians come to the table determined to make and discuss real offers and engage in a real dialogue. It is important that we do that. And I have said before, and I will repeat again, countries that have peaceful programs do not have problems proving to people that they are peaceful. So we are not going to get trapped into a delay after delay process here. It's important to engage, and I think it is incumbent on the Iranians to prove that they're prepared to meet our willingness, President Obama's willingness, again and again stated by the president, to be open to a diplomatic resolution here.
The United States and many of its allies suspect Iran is trying to build a nuclear bomb. Iran insists its nuclear program is strictly for peaceful civilian purposes. A new report says regions of the Middle East are quickly losing their fresh water reserves. University of California, Irvine scientists and colleagues used space technology to study the problem. We spoke with one of the authors, UCI's Jay Famoletti.
The most important things that we learned about the study are the very rapid rates of groundwater depletion that are happening in the region. Of course, it's known to the local residents and to the outside world that the depletion is happening, but the widespread nature of the depletion and the overall amount of the depletion is very difficult to understand from the ground. And so our work with satellites really helped us put together a larger scale picture that's pretty compelling.
In layman's terms, could you give us an idea of the scope of this problem?
Well, the scope of the problem is huge. The amount of water that's been lost is about 145 cubic kilometers, which is about the volume of the Dead Sea. So, of course, that's a lot of water. And about 60% of that, or 90 cubic kilometers, is from groundwater loss, which is most likely being used for irrigation. So if you want to think about that in human terms, of course it depends on per capita water use, but you're talking about water for tens of millions of people on an annual basis, and you know, maybe as many as 100 million people.
Is this due to global warming, or is it from overuse for agriculture, or what?
Well,
we
can never really say with one study or one event that this is happening because of global warming. But certainly there was a very dry, prolonged drought period in that region. And it's a very natural human response, not just in the Middle East, but all over the world, to hit the groundwater reserves pretty hard during times of drought, because by definition there's no surface water, there's no rainfall, there's no river flow available. But with respect to global warming, that part of the world, the arid part of the world, is expected to become even more dry. So these sorts of prolonged drought situations will be increasing in the future. And so I'm quite concerned about it on a personal level, and I hope that the rest of the world is too.
Jay Famoletti, a professor of Earth System Science at the University of California, Irvine. We hope to bring you more of his remarks Monday and find out how the scientists use satellites to determine water levels in the Middle East.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.